Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. The 10th anniversary of 9/11 has just passed, and I thought it might be a good time to do an update on the state of terrorism and what has happened during the last 10 years as far as defeating terrorism or bringing it to bay. Austin, we'll start with you this morning. What are your feelings 10 years after the event? Are we safer today now than we were then? Have we accomplished anything over the last 10 years? Where are we at?
Well, I think that we have accomplished a great deal. For one thing, at least in terms of limiting, stopping Al-Qaeda 9/11 type terror attacks in the United States, we haven't had a repeat of 9/11. We have had attempted terror attacks, and I regard what Major Hassan did at Fort Hood to be a successful terror attack, but it certainly wasn't on the scale of 9/11. So we quickly, and of course this is extremely hard to do, but we managed to do it, and I think we had a fairly well-functioning organization within, you know, somewhere 18 to 24 months. We took our various security organizations, then include the FBI and its counterintelligence and counterterrorism components, our NSA, CIA, NRO, intelligence capabilities, military capabilities, and remember the word fusion, Dan. You know, we're going to have intelligence fusion.
Yes,
we worked on that. In some ways, forced it. Jim has written a lot about this over the years too. But you know, we improved it. We also emphasized our special operations capabilities, because SOCOM, Special Operations Command, Commandos, you know, Special Forces, SEALs, and the like, have the kind of skills to operate across a spectrum of operate the entire spectrum of from counter crime to counter terror, and also even into, you know, conventional warfare. And so they're an important component of not simply gaining intelligence, but also direct action or strike. We also, look, everybody's got to be somewhere, which is the answer to an old vaudeville joke. Nation states do harbor terrorists. Now, we can argue about whether Afghanistan is really a nation state or a kaleidoscope of tribes. It's got the superstructure of a nation state, but it's not really along the same lines of a modern nation state. But that was Al-Qaeda's training base. We knocked that out. We knocked Al-Qaeda, and early on, dealt them a major, you know, I'd call it an information warfare blow, but psychological blow, because Al-Qaeda is one of the important elements of their propaganda before 9/11 and certainly after 9/11, is that they had divine sanction. And what I mean by that is that God was on their side. And that was part of the calculated appeal. And you could, you know, it wasn't just grievance and indignation, but see, we're striking back at the West. We're striking back at the United States. We're striking back at godlessness. And all that was bound into the propaganda pitch. I call attention to bin Laden's now fairly famous audio statement of early October 2001, the one where he talks about 80 years of Muslim indignation since the end of the caliphate, because not only hooked to this divine sanction that was, you know, God's on our side, is that he also was spilling a myth, an attractive myth to young, alienated Muslim men, mostly, is that if we restored the caliphate and we lived in the way the early believers, the early followers, Salafis, Salafists, that we will, our power will return and our prestige and all this, these twin towers, this sign of economic modernity and globalism, they'll just disintegrate like they did when we hit them with their own, we hit the America with their own airplanes. So by the end of December 2001, January 2002, that claim was already suspect, because if the United States is such a bunch of couch potatoes and so, you know, run by whatever satanic forces, how come they ran you out? Iraq. You know, Iraq in its own... Well, a lot of people forget that two of the three things that bin Laden, in one of his early statements on declaring war on the United States, through the accusations, actually dealt with Iraq and all the Iraqis that were suffering under the UN sanctions regimen and the children dying and the like. And then the other one was the occupation of quote-unquote holy places, or threat to the holy places, with superpower infidel troops in Saudi Arabia. They were there because part of enforcing the sanctions on Iraq. I just bring that up because that gets lost in a lot of the discussion. Two of the major things that Al-Qaeda pulled up directly reflected on what was regarded by a good portion of the world as a success, which was Desert Storm, reversing Saddam's invasion of Kuwait. So, you know, Iraq factored into the way Al-Qaeda was building its propaganda pitch, among other things. We took the war to the heart of the politically dysfunctional Arab, primarily Arab Muslim Middle East. I know Iraq's got Kurds and they're not Arabs, but they, and, you know, here's, over time, Al-Qaeda did what sociopathic terrorists do, is that they just murder and continue to murder. And we pointed out on strategy page, there was a article I wrote not too long ago on this, mentioning a couple of things that actually Jim wrote in 2005 and 2006, based on what was going on in the Arab press, that Al-Qaeda, his reputation was in shreds. I'm going to paraphrase one of those strategy page posts, but it went to the effect, you know, dead Iraqis are killing Al-Qaeda. Now, I think that's close to what Jim wrote, either 2005 or 2006. It's on the strategy page. Go look them up. It's been there for now some 6 years. What that was an indication that the United States was winning, again, this political, information, psychological war against Al-Qaeda. We turned their own viciousness was being exposed, not killing Germans, not killing Frenchmen, not killing Americans, you know, exporting the war to quote-unquote infidel states, but these guys were murdering fellow Muslims. Maybe a bunch of them were Shias, but a bunch of them were. And, you know, the thing is, maybe they're killing fellow Arabs. Now, you ask, what have we done? I think I've made a case right there that we've pushed. We made great strides on the against Al-Qaeda's greatest strength, which is that it was an information power, and that it was, you know, it had this capability of appealing to these alienated, young, unemployed Muslim men, and you know, give them this. Preaching a virtue of violence. Well, it didn't get him anywhere. And now bin Laden, a decade later, he finally got killed by the SEALs. I'd say this as an aside. I would have loved to have seen him caught within the first 2 months. But there's some utility on the fact that he wasn't a martyr. Al-Qaeda was eroded and corroded while he was still alive. And then his elimination is just a kind of final proof that you didn't have divine sanction. Now, are we safer today? I think we are. I think the United States, you're talking about the U.S. being safer because we're much more aware. At the same time, and this is something else we've written about on Strategy Pay several times, they're not going away. The threat hasn't diminished in a couple of senses. Al-Qaeda as an organization is badly damaged. Badly damaged. It's not still active in Yemen. It's still got cells. Ayman al-Zawahiri is probably somewhere in Pakistan. I don't know for sure. But they're badly damaged. Nevertheless, Al-Qaeda, the idea, still has influence, despite the success we've had in challenging that idea. And that's following the pattern of the anarchists of the 19th century. Heck, even in the late 20th century, some of the anarchist ideas were influential to some of our homegrown terrorists in the United States. I'm thinking of the Unabomber. If you bother to read some of the Unabomber's screed, it was a mishmash of many ideologies, but he had material in there that was right out of something you'd read from European anarchists of the late 19th century. You know, we're going to destroy the corrupt system that exists, and then suddenly out of this destruction, justice will emerge. And that could, Ted Kaczynski, I think that was the name of the Unabomber. He's just one example, and one I can think of immediately. We've written several times from several different angles that militant Islamist terrorism kind of tracks along with militant anarchist terrorism, and it's still going to have its appeal. Dangerous individuals or small cells will try to launch attacks, but Al Qaeda wasn't productive, and in some ways, even though they're trying to subvert, or their allies are trying to subvert Arab Spring revolutions, that's another component of it. They really don't have jobs programs. And a lot of the Arab Spring revolutions, I want jobs and I want Twitter accounts. So that's they're having to modify themselves as circumstances that they didn't foresee have appeared. Anyway, I hope that answered your question.
Yeah. Jim, your thoughts?
Well, in the decade before 9/11, there were growing number of attacks by Al-Qaeda. There was, of course, the one first attempt against the World Trade Center in 1993. I was down there at the time. And overseas, there was feeble attempts to take down bin Laden. We were chasing Al-Qaeda around. We chased them out of Sudan and Saudi Arabia, and so they ended up in Afghanistan. And there was a sort of a vague feeling in the West, in the United States. I mean, we got this through the media, who are usually vague, that, you know, there was something going on in the Arab world. There was some kind of unrest. I mean, it was difficult to explain. I mean, what were they complaining about? We were sending them hundreds of billions of dollars a year for their oil. You go there, and all you see is new housing, shopping malls, people driving around in cars, new cars, and what have you. So, hey, what's the problem? We later find out that, as Austin had explained, that the Salafists, you know, these conservative Muslims, had been preaching for years. I mean, we're talking back. Austin mentioned the end of the caliphate. The Sultan of Turkey had been the caliph, had been the self-declared caliph for several centuries, and the Arabs hated that. But as Austin so eloquently explained, you know, the Al-Qaeda was revising history on the fly, and nobody was noticing it. But anyway, the Arabs were freed by the Allies Of course, the Arabs, many Arabs call that the period of colonial bondage, and promptly given, you know, they're set up in their own countries, which again is cursed out for various reasons. You know, the borders weren't right. They didn't give us enough money. Whatever, whatever. It goes on and on.
This is post-World War I that Jim's talking about.
Yeah, this is after World War I. 1918 was when, early 1920s was when the caliphate was officially abolished. Actually, the Turks, you know, said, hey, we don't need this anymore. I'm sad at Turk. Since 9/11, we have gotten, the media has perpetuated the illusion that our efforts to defend ourselves, Israel gets hit with this too, have somehow inflamed the Arabs and created more terrorists. But the fact of the matter is, the number of terrorists has been growing for over half a century. It's been grown not by accident, often not even, in fact, it's no accident that 15 of the 19 terrorists involved in the 9/11 attacks were Saudis. The reason for that is, has something to do with the money that's been pouring into Saudi Arabia since after World War II, a little before World War II actually had started. The Islamic conservatism is very strong in Saudi Arabia. It always has been. I mean, that's where the most holy shrines of Islam are. And when the Saudi family, when Ibn Aziz al-Saud established the kingdom in the 1920s and 30s, it took him a while because he basically had to deal with all these tribes. But he also had to deal with a very conservative Wahhabi strain of Islam, which was predominant in Arabia. It started in the 18th century and it got stronger and stronger. It was sort of I'm more Islamic than thou sort of thing. But anyway, it was very xenophobic. It was very, we're hearing it to this day. Every time you hear, Islamic fanatics described as hateful towards non-Muslims, believing that, the world should be all Islamic and violence is, allowed to make that happen. This is coming from the Wahhabis. Now, the Saudi royal family has had a hard time controlling them. Obviously, after 9/11, some American observers, even some people in the State Department who tend to be more sensitive to Arab feelings, said, they haven't been too successful. I mean, basically, if you cornered, which actually happened after 9/11, some of the Arabists in the State Department, who were notorious for, so to speak, intellectually getting in bed with the people they're supposed to be studying, they admitted that Islamic radicalism was rampant in Saudi Arabia, and most of it was paid for by the state as a form of bribery to keep the Islamic radicals from getting more radical inside Saudi Arabia. Because in 1979, there had been an incident where heavily armed Islamic radicals had gotten inside the holy places in Mecca, which is apostasy. This is the worst possible thing a Muslim can do, carry guns into those holy places. And that was a huge scandal. And in contrition, the royal family, they basically subsidized Wahhabi missionaries to go all over the world and to set up, they had plenty of money, set up schools, free schools, boarding schools for your children, and we'll turn them into, without telling the parents, that basically turn them into little, Islamic terrorists. And that was basically ignored. There was a little bit of it, but it was ignored. I mean, I did come across it, and I said, hey, what's going on here? And I asked people down in Washington, and some people in the Pentagon were aware of it. Apparently, the only place where there was a fairly good awareness of that situation was in the special forces. But nobody really listens to them because they're a bunch of crazy snake eaters. State Department said, yeah, but we have it under control. Of course, they always say that. And of course, at the political level in Congress and the White House, what are you talking about? FBI, clueless. I mean, to give you an example, after 1993, I was the terrorism, the go-to guy for several local, you know, TV stations. And one of them were, you know, had me day after day film me little bits about, you know, who tried to blow up the World Trade Center. And I had been following Islamic, radicalism, you know, around the city, as it were. And I knew that there'd been a big stink down in Brooklyn where somebody had been murdered because of an internal feud in a mosque. Actually, the police suspected there was more than one murder involved, but they only had one body. Then, you know, there was more of that reported in the papers, and then it struck me, the guy who was the radical cleric was the same guy who had been chased out of Egypt for being part of the Muslim Brotherhood, who had been trying to bring down the Egyptian government. Now, the government eventually won, but all those bombs going off in Egypt in the 1990s, most people don't remember that, was because of this guy and his cronies. He came to the United States as a political refugee. He was being oppressed back in Egypt for, you know, terrorism. That's how crazy things were in the 1990s. And he later went to jail because he was the guy who basically organized and inspired local Muslims to make a fertilizer bomb and try and bring down the World Trade Center towers. At the time, he was just an innocent, you know, political refugee. And that was the mindset. The FBI, what are you talking about? This guy, he's a refugee. That's what our marching orders from the White House are. And nobody who cares about their career in the FBI is going to contradict what the FBI, White House tells them to believe. That all changed after 9/11, but we didn't understand that it had all changed. Nothing really changed on the ground, you know, where the terrorists were, but our understanding of it changed so rapidly and so dramatically that we assume, my God, what's happened all of a sudden? The only thing that happened all of a sudden is people opened their eyes to what was really going on. I mean, it's not that this stuff wasn't reported. It was. But it was buried, you know, in the back of the Sunday paper somewhere. And nobody was paying attention. You know, I get 30 seconds on the TV news, local or network and what have you, and yawns, you know, could be detected in the studio. It just did not connect. It was not considered news. After 9/11, it was news, and from there came the fairy tale that our counterattack against the terrorists was creating more terrorists. No. You did not have to create more terrorists. They were well on their way to doing that, you know, long before Bin Laden and company decided to attack the West. And of course, the reason he decided to attack the West was because the oppressive leaders in the Arab states that he was trying to overcome, because they were corrupt, they were not Islamic enough, et cetera, were very good at running police states. They knew how to stay in power. And Bin Laden was unable to, Bin Laden was really way out of his depth, you know, and trying to generate a revolution, especially in the Persian Gulf, where the local monarchs have learned how to keep the people happy. They, as the English like to say, they stuff their mouths with gold. I mean, basically, they buy off their own people, and they do it very well. I mean, you'll hear a lot of educated Saudis, if you get to sit down and have dinner with them, they complain about that. They say, we have a lot of grievances, but everybody's doing so well. And nobody wants to rock the boat because they still have a grandparent around who remembers the bad old days when everybody was dirt poor and nobody lived, you know, the average lifespan was about 40-some years old. So Bin Laden decided, I need more publicity. And what better way to get it is to attack where most of the TV cameras and TV studios are. Well, that's New York City. Let's bring down the towers. And they got fixated on that. And, of course, they eventually did it. But while these guys were playing, you know, media games, the radicalization of young Muslims continued, you know, basically in spite of whatever Al-Qaeda was doing, because as Austin pointed out, yes, we did report those opinion surveys of how the attitude towards Al-Qaeda declined as more Muslims got killed. But, it depended upon whether or not Muslims had been killed in your area. If your country had not been hit, for example, in Saudi Arabia, it wasn't until 2003 when we invaded Iraq And the local Al-Qaeda supporters, you know, said, this, you cannot do this. And they started setting up bombs in Saudi Arabia. And all of a sudden, boom, as if by magic, Saudis turned on Al-Qaeda. But after about 4 years, the Saudi government basically wiped out the local Al-Qaeda enthusiasts, drove them into Syria, not Syria, well, some into Syria, but mostly into Yemen and Pakistan and what have you. And when the explosions disappeared, basically after 2006, I think was the last one, now Al-Qaeda is steadily becoming more popular in Saudi Arabia. So you see how this works. There is a attitude in the Arab world that it's swell to inflict pain and suffering on non-Muslims, especially in the West. I mean, there's no other way to put it. Because I had a lot of friends in who have worked in Saudi Arabia when 9/11 came around, and even they were shocked at the number of celebrations they saw going on. You know, on the TV where the towers collapsing, and, you know, Saudis were yelling, hugging each other and cheering like, you know, they just won the World Cup. And these were guys who had Saudi friends, you know, they say nice things to each other, yada, yada. And all of a sudden they were cheering the slaughter of thousands of Westerners. You know, go figure. You know, inferiority. I mean, there's any number of explanations have been offered for it, but basically there it is. And there it still is. The only thing that's been learned in the last 10 years is if you mess with the bull, you get the horn, as they say down in Texas. And that applies, you know, and basically a lot of people in the West, oh, no, no, we don't want to come across as mean, you know, and vindictive. But the fact of the matter is, that's the only thing they understand. Now, at the same time this is going on, a lot of Arabs understand that the problems are not all this fairy tale crap, you know, we're being oppressed by the West. It's internal. They know the corruption wasn't brought in by the West. It was there long before the West even existed. And all the bad government and what have you, that's all of local manufacture. And so you have the Arab reform movement, which is sponsored in part by the royal family of Saudi Arabia. Now, they're not talking about democracy, because most of these countries are still basically dictatorships. Even in Egypt, as we've reported, sure, they threw out Mubarak, but it looks like the new gang is going to be the same as the old gang. And that's what a lot of people fear is going to happen in Tunisia, in Libya, eventually in Syria. And a lot of Arabs are understanding this now. They don't like to admit it because it is embarrassing. Because they go through all this hoopla of you're oppressing us, all this cheering when the towers come down, the 9/11 attacks, all this, you know, this Schadenfreude, this bad mouthing in the United States and what have you. You know, they really believe in the old saying that no good deed goes unpunished. But they are aware of what they're doing. That a lot of it is just BS. And now when they have to admit that, you know, we've met the enemy and they are us, and how are we going to deal with this? And there's a huge probability, that this whole thing's just going to recycle and they're going to be right back where they started from. So the worst thing to come out of the last decade counterterrorism effort is to make the Arabs aware of the fact that they are the problem.
And Jim, to some degree, we've seen that as one of the elements in Arab Spring. You heard that out of Tunisian,
yes,
and Egyptian crowds. We've heard a gaggle of things out of the Libyans. But part of what's going on in Arab Spring, it's an extremely complex situation. I know that. But there are those, many of them, what we would call a modernizing, I would call them, you know, modernizing revolutionaries, to say, look, at some level, we're responsible for this as well. You can say that Mubarak was propped up by the United States and the West, yes, no, but really, Mubarak was, you know, in a long line of followers from the coup led by Gamal Abdel Nasser.
Yeah, and something else you have to say about that. When people say you supported all these tyrants, the whole point, the United States doesn't have friends. We have interests. In other words, if there's a tyrannical government and we want to establish diplomatic relations simply so we can speak to them, doesn't mean we support them. And if we try too hard to basically overthrow a tyrannical government, then we're accused of interfering in the affairs of a foreign country, uninvited, butting in and what have you. I mean, look what happened with Iraq. Many people were saying for years, you should do something about Saddam. Well, we did something. And what thanks do you get?
Well, it's the situation of damned if you do and damned if you don't.
Exactly.
That comes back to some of what you were, one of the ways to talk about this blame, and I think blame somebody else for your problems, psychological transference and all the other, that may move into psychobabble, but there's some element of truth to saying when you sit there and you're blaming everybody else, you're blaming the Treaty of Versailles. I hadn't heard anybody say that one in a while, but essentially it comes back to blaming the West for conditions in former Ottoman Empire provinces inhabited by Arab Muslims on the Sykes-Picot or the agreements or the Treaty of Versailles and the like. There's a component of truth to it, but you're also, we're talking 80, 90 years later, we're also talking about these autocratic, dictatorial Arab governments run by Arabs, and they spend most of their time oppressing their own people. And their game was, let's blame somebody else and try to deflect internal opposition.
Well, I mean, tyrants have been doing that for thousands of
states. I mean, that was a technique.
Yeah, but that's tyranny 101. You don't even have to be a tyrant. Any government that's in trouble, they look for some external excitement to divert attention from the problems they got at home. I mean, the classic example in the West was the military junta in Argentina in 1982. Let's go take back the Malvinas, and the British won't mind.
Well, and that's the Galtieri regime, and they were under such deserted pressure there in Argentina, and they ginned up a war with Great Britain, much to their own regret, and collapse.
Well, actually, for Argentina, it worked out because that gave the last bit of oomph to throw out the military junta. Maybe the same thing is happening now with Venezuela. They've been trying to create this foreign boogeyman with Colombia, with the United States, well, actually, with all their neighbors, Brazil. And because the country is going to pieces economically and politically, so what do? You try and get people's attention diverted, and in the long run, it never works. But in the short run, gee, it makes for great journalism.
Well, you see, here's the takeaway on this, Dan, and as we there's more to say here. Maybe we come back to this discussion topic again in the next few months. But that what I said about Arab citizens, this might be a way of putting it. I actually use this in that new book on Ataturk, where Ataturk makes a point after the Turkish War of Independence that he wants Turks to see themselves as citizens, not subjects. That's the difference. You've been a subject of the Sultan, but now you're going to take responsibility as an actor for as an actor in a new kind of a system where, you also receive, but you act responsibly. What I've seen in some at play, and this is different, this is very different than Al-Qaeda's technique of blaming the West and blaming everybody, blaming everybody else, is that there's a component in the Arab Spring revolutions of saying, we need to take this ourselves, because some of what's going on, we're responsible for, and if we're going to change it, we're going to change it. Now, where it's going to lead, and I don't know, none of us do, is it trying to be, is the radical factions of the Muslim Brotherhood, who are aligned with the militant Islamists, they are militant Islamists, going to try to undermine it in Egypt? Yeah, that's what's been going on the last couple of weeks, including the attack on the Israeli embassy and the like, at least in my opinion. But that acceptance of your own responsibility, that's a big change in the last 10 years, Dan. And do I relate it all to 9/11? No, but to some degree I relate it to the fact that Bin Laden failed and the United States stepped up. We didn't go away, and we changed our tune about seeing these guys as petty criminals or minor threats and then understood what they had been up to socially and culturally. I'm talking about the militant Islamists and the way Jim described their hijacking of madrasa educations.
Yep.
Big deal.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. We've run out of time, and that was, I think, a great overview of the last 10 years and where we've come to. And we'll talk to you next time. Thanks.
Bye, guys.
Bye.